ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Free Expression with Jerry Baker.
Hello and welcome to Free Expression from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jerry Baker, editor-at-large of the Journal. If you're not already a subscriber, please, you know where to sign up. Do so wherever you do your podcast listening. This week, it's 6 months to Election Day. The nation's campuses are in uproar. The Republican presidential candidate is in a courtroom. And the incumbent president and Democratic candidate is in a stew of domestic and international crises. Yes, welcome to the 2024 presidential election again. We're going to take a look at the state of the race and the many trends and vectors that will determine the outcome in the next 26 weeks with one of the leading analysts and commentators on our elections. For some time now, opinion polls have suggested a clear, potentially decisive pattern in the race. The two main candidates are neck and neck in the national vote. The Real Clear Politics polling average today, we're recording this on Tuesday, shows Donald Trump on 47%, just 1.5 points up on Joe Biden, who has been closing that gap a little in recent weeks. But in the key swing states, Trump continues to have a small, but apparently very significant lead. With the vast majority of states seemingly set to fall one way or the other, there are probably 7 states that will determine the outcome in the Electoral College this year. In 4 of those states, Trump maintains a steady and clear advantage. According to that Real Clear Politics average, in Arizona, Trump's up by 5 points. In Georgia, he's up by 4. In Nevada, he's up by 4.5. And in North Carolina, Trump leads by 5.5 points. In the other 3 states, Trump is also ahead, but by a wafer-thin margin. In Michigan and Pennsylvania, Trump's up by 1. And in Wisconsin, he's up by 2. Now, the Electoral College arithmetic is such that if this picture holds steady, Biden faces a perilously narrow path to victory. He would either have to overturn Trump's solid lead in one or more of those first 4 states, or he'd have to win all 3 of the latter states that are on a knife edge. And even then, if he did that, he would win the presidency by, yes, 270 to 268 electoral votes. And of course, there are still 6 months to go. In previous elections, much has changed in this critical last phase of the campaign. And in this year's contest, with wars in the Middle East and Europe, radical extremists seemingly taking over many college campuses, Trump on trial facing felony charges, and a growing uncertainty to the economic outlook, there is much that could still sway the result. So to discuss this, I'm pleased to say I'm joined this week by Amy Walter, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter. Over a quarter century at the heart of the business of political commentary and analysis, Amy's earned a reputation, a rare reputation, I should say, for astuteness, wisdom, and objectivity. In fact, many of us, I would say, would regard her assessment of the state of national politics as just about peerless. And Amy Walter joins me now. Amy, thanks for joining Free Expression.
Happy to do it.
Well, there's lots to talk about. I want to obviously get into the state of the presidential race, national polls, swing state polls, third-party candidates, all the other things that you spend your hours and days analyzing in detail. But let's start with kind of immediate events, because there's obviously a lot going on. I wrote my column this week about how New York is really the center of the universe. One end of Manhattan, we have Donald Trump sitting in a courtroom facing felony charges. At the other end of Manhattan, we have Columbia University in a state of complete uproar and disarray. But let's start with these campus protests and the kind of challenge that they may, well, let me ask you straight out, what much of a concern do you think they are for Joe Biden? I mean, we've got the Democratic convention coming up with historic sort of resonance in Chicago. Yeah. We've got this evidence that, you know, there's a chunk of younger Democratic voters who are maybe very unhappy about the war. How do you read all this?
We have a country right now that feels maybe more chaotic than people remember it being in quite some time. And I do think when we have events like what we're seeing on campuses, and those events get a great deal of media coverage, especially ones that are recordable, right? So people are actually seeing these things, whether they're getting it from TV or TikTok or whatever form. And I think living in a moment of time where almost everything now gets broken down by your politics, right? Where you eat, where you shop, what neighborhood you live in is also driven by what it says about your ideology or about your partisan preference. So I think there are a lot of individuals out there who see these protests. And if you are a progressive-minded person, you are checking in, you're going, well, what's going on here? Oh, well, I see that this is people who I would agree with, that there are occupiers and occupied and there are oppressors, and I want to be on the side of defending the oppressed. And so I'm going to be on their side. If you have more of a conservative lean, what you see is absolute chaos, and that there needs to be order, and somebody needs to, rather than free expression, and somebody needs to handle this. And so I'm pretty sure that that's where the country is probably viewing it, again, for those who aren't completely already focused on this issue. Maybe a shorter way of saying it is this. I don't know that that many people are as passionate about this issue as the campus protests and the response to them would have you think. I think that there are a lot of people who feel passionately about the fact that there are these campus protests, and that is different from taking a side in Israel-Hamas. At the same time, we don't know whether these issues are going to be the kind of thing that, again, regular voters are going to be using to guide their vote. And even for younger voters, what we're seeing in the data, at least, whether it's the Harvard Youth Poll, or I just was looking at a CNN poll, for most voters under 34, the top issues for them are pretty similar to the top issues for regular folks over the age of 34, which is the economy and the cost of living. They're very concerned about issues like gun violence. Those all rate higher than concerns about Israel. And then in the CNN poll, when you ask about whether you approve or disapprove of the job Biden is doing, a good number of people who are Biden voters, they say they're voting for Biden in 2024. About 44% of them say, I don't approve of what he's doing or what his administration is doing in terms of Israel. So that, I think, is sort of how it breaks down politically. To your point about there being two sides of New York, I think that's a really good point, because if you were at the Biden campaign, your hope was these next weeks, last week and this week, would have been all about the Trump trial, right? That's all we'd be talking about. What happened at the Trump trial? What is Trump saying? What did he tweet? What did he say coming out of the courtroom? What were some of the most salacious things that came out of the court? Instead, what we're seeing is a lot, not just what's happening at Columbia, but now seeing these protests all around the country at college campuses. And as you pointed out, it's likely that we're going to see them move beyond college campuses. And so it means that the split screen that Biden really wanted, the, hey, I'm here being president and doing good presidenting things, and my opponent is stuck in court having to defend all these salacious things that he did, it's not as clean and clear as that.
Thanks for that. You've expressed it in very clear terms. I guess the follow-up is, while the issue itself of Israel-Hamas may have low saliency, should we say, in terms of most voters, and we probably say that foreign policy generally does, and however horrified people may have been by October 7th, and however sympathetic some people may be to the Palestinian cause, we can probably assume that's a kind of a low saliency thing. There are two elements to it, aren't there? One is the protests, and especially, again, if we did see anything like a kind of repeat of 1968, the Democratic Convention in Chicago, I'm not saying we will, but if we did, as these protests consume attention, do they create a general sense of chaos and disorder, and particularly among the ruling Democratic Party? And secondly, you know, again, I don't think in the end electorally became a big factor, but is there a risk in key states where there might be very likely to be very narrow margins? People joke about Biden believes in a two-state solution to the Middle East problem, that the two states are Pennsylvania and Michigan. Do you think there is a real risk here that enough voters could be animated by this issue? And remember, we have something else we'll come on to talk about. We have these third-party candidates, particularly in the form of Cornel West, perhaps, and maybe Jill Stein, do kind of offer a kind of a way out for people, you know, who really are dissatisfied with Biden, the Democratic Party, but are certainly not going to vote for Trump, to express their dissatisfaction that way. Do you think it's electorally salient in any way?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that the fact that it doesn't take much, if you take just a small percentage of those students or younger people who feel very strongly about this issue, and they say, you know what, I can't vote for Trump, but Biden, no good, I'm staying home. Maybe they stay third party, but they say, I really want to make a point by letting this administration know that they can't take our votes for granted. And that matters a lot, because for Biden, who has a coalition that is 100% dependent on voters who dislike Trump coming back to Biden, right? That it's not so much he needs to win over people who already like him. He needs to win over people who may not like him all that much, but really dislike Trump even more. So I do think that matters a lot. As for the chaos issue, I mean, this feels somewhat similar to what we saw, say, in 2020, where you had protests after the killing of George Floyd, and you had peaceful protests, you had not so peaceful protests, and then you had some of these groups talking about things like defunding the police, right? And so if what it looks like is, oh boy, the Democratic Party or progressive-minded people, you know, what they want is for there to be no police. These politically correct areas are so terrified about upsetting people's speech rights that they won't even bring order to this chaos. So I do think there may be something, again, that it is able to become apparent later on in the campaign to regular voters who say the Democratic Party maybe stands for something that looks more like they're more willing to accept chaos. And look, it feeds into, and I think Trump has done a pretty good job of connecting this to what is happening at the border, right? You put Democrats in charge and what you're going to get is things being out of control. And you put me back in office, things are not going to be out of control anymore. And it is harder for Biden to push back on whether it is the border or this because of the need to keep his base from rebelling even more than they have been on some of these topics.
All right, let's get into stuff you particularly spend your days poring over, which is the numbers. So start with the national picture. It was the case, and certainly until a week or so ago, sort of the general narrative was, while Trump had seemed to open up a little bit of a lead in the national poll, and by the way, I'll preface all of these remarks by saying polling is, you know, highly unreliable, the best of times, and we're more than 6 months out still from the election, so people can take it or leave it. You look at polls, we all look at polls, we all use them to form our assessment of where the race is. So going back to the end of last year, actually Trump seemed to have a small lead in the national polling. I'm use the Real Clear Politics average, or you can use 538 or your own numbers or whatever. It was a sort of small 3-point lead. That seemed to close over the last couple of months. People ascribed it to various things, maybe the consolidation of the race as the two candidates both emerged victorious from their primaries. Maybe it was something to do with Biden's State of the Union, whatever. And the two candidates are now, you know, pretty well neck and neck again in the polls. Maybe, you know, a couple of last national polls of Trump seems to have opened up a little bit of a small lead. And again, we're going to come on to talk about the really important stuff in terms of the outcome of the election, which is the swing states. But where do you see the kind of national picture right now? What has happened? What's the state of the race?
Yeah, I do think that this race is, at the national level, one that is basically tied, which is not great news for Biden, because if you look at just, let's say, the last election, where Biden took 51% of the vote, that didn't translate to 51% in those swing states. In some, he got 50, in others, you know, he wins with a little over 49%. So tying at the national level sounds a lot better than losing at the national level. But what he's got to be able to do to win re-election is to show that he's been able to get back the level of support he had in 2020, especially among independent voters, which right now, at least in a couple of polls that I've been looking at recently, Trump's still leading among independent voters. And where Latino voters go is going to be critical. I think part of the reason the numbers got closer in these last couple of weeks is a lot of Democratic-leaning voters who had been hoping that there would be another candidate, not Joe Biden, but maybe another Democrat was going to come sweep in, or couldn't quite wrap their heads around the fact that this really was going to be a rematch. I think they've now resigned themselves to that fact.
Yeah.
And so they're just kind of getting back in line. So the next group of voters that Biden needs to get back are those ones that they don't really line up as pure Democrats, but they have lined up against Trump in the past. And again, I think the challenge for the Biden campaign is, if this is an election about the policy, who do you think will do a better job on the economy? Who would do a better job on immigration? What about the war in the Middle East? Biden's going to lose on that score. If it is, what do you think about Donald Trump, the person? Let's make it much more about his unflattering personality, his style, behavior, the things that are coming out in the trial as well, that's where Biden has an opportunity to reorient those swing voters away from Trump, or at least away from making it just purely a referendum on Biden.
We're going to take a short break there, but when we come back, I'll have more with Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report. We're talking about, of course, the presidential election. Stay with us.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kind of heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
You're listening to Free Expression with Jerry Baker. Don't forget, you can listen to the latest episode anytime on your smart speaker. Just say, play the Opinion Free Expression podcast. Now, back to Jerry Baker.
I'm back with Amy Walter, publisher and editor-in-chief of The Cook Report with Amy Walter. We're talking about the presidential election. All right, so let's look at the battleground, because as you say, there has now been a pretty well-established pattern of a distinction between where the national race is and where the race comes out in the key swing states. We know Trump lost the popular vote in 2016 and won the election nonetheless because of the swing state, because of the advantage they have in the Electoral College. He lost by a pretty wide margin in the popular vote, and certainly by recent historical standards, more than 4 percentage points, but came, as we know, within 44,000 votes in 4 key swing states of still pulling it off a victory even there. Again, it is once again about the swing states, and in particular about this potential divergent behavior of the swing states from the national vote. I read out in my introduction list of 7 states. Do you agree that the battleground is probably those 7 states, Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania? Do you think there's anything we might be overlooking, or is that really the battleground?
That sure feels like, I think it's more likely than not that list will actually narrow rather than expand.
Right.
And that you may see some of these states become a harder lift for Biden, especially North Carolina is already a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
Georgia is going to be, I think, another hard one. You sort of go back, I don't know, even back to 2012. And the theory of the case from Democrats was that, look, Democrats are going to win presidential elections for the foreseeable future because they've put together this multi-ethnic, multi-racial coalition that, quite frankly, that's where the population is. And unless the Republicans can find a way to win over those voters, they can't win. And here we are now in 2024, where Trump is pulling in a decent share of Latino voters. It kind of goes all over the map. But let's say even he gets up to where George W. Bush was, somewhere in the low 40%, and they are now a bigger percent of the electorate than they were in 2004. But it also means that Joe Biden's path, instead of being in those swing states with a significant Latino and Black population, that he wins because he holds on to those states with a lot of white voters, like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, right? And
yeah.
Michigan.
Yeah.
Every candidate has to figure out, okay, how do I build my coalition? And can Biden swap out, say, he does a little bit worse among even like Black voters in Detroit or Milwaukee, but makes up for that with stronger showing in the suburbs around Milwaukee, yeah, or around Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Just very quickly before I come on to the detail of that, some people have suggested that maybe Florida, which has been seemingly trending pretty solidly red in the last few elections, and certainly in the last gubernatorial election, which DeSantis won in a landslide, as we know, but maybe because of the saliency, the fact that the abortion issue is going to be on the ballot there, that may drag that back into competitive status. Just quickly, how do you see Florida?
I don't know that that is enough to bring it back because, as I said, I think that the issue of abortion is one where a voter can pick on a ballot initiative to support abortion rights, but then still go for Trump, right? When everything is wrapped up in a candidate, right? You will have more access or less access to abortion based on who you're voting for. That feels a lot different than based on, you know, you can vote for a ballot initiative and you can vote for a candidate.
Right. In a curious way, it may actually diminish the sort of Democratic argument that you've got to vote for a Democrat to save abortion rights, because actually, when you put it on the ballot like that, you could happily vote against the 6-week ban and say, but I'm still voting for Donald Trump. You know, I'm in control.
That's right.
Exactly as you say. So these 7 states that everybody talks about then does seem to be narrowing. I just read out in my introduction again with all the caveats about polling, but the real clear average polls right now have Trump ahead in four of those states, in Arizona by 5, Georgia by 4, Nevada by 4.5, and North Carolina, as you say, by 5.5, you know, suggesting, again, they're not by any means impregnable for the Republicans, but that's trending kind of solidly up to and maybe even beyond the margin of error in his direction. And that would leave only three states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, where he's up by 1 in Michigan, Pennsylvania, up by 2 in Wisconsin, that would be really competitive. And again, I've done the math. I'm not as good as it as you are. You know it much better than I, but I've done the Electoral College math. So Biden did lose those first four states. And then it's up with those other three states. He has to sweep those three states.
Just to get to 270.
To win the Electoral College 270 to 268.
Yeah.
Does suggest the electoral map is really pretty solidly weighted in Trump's favor right now.
Yeah. And I think it rarely works out this way that you get a nice clean divide like that. This party wins half and this other party wins half. And there we go. It usually breaks more decidedly for one than the other. And we obviously saw that in 2016. It wasn't just losing one blue wall state, right? They all went.
Yep.
And it wasn't just that Trump lost those Sunbelt states. He lost all of them.
Yep.
Now, we tend to think of, well, but if you only win by 10,000 votes or 1 point, that's not really a sweep. Well, in this day and age, that's a sweep. I say momentum, it doesn't have to be that he's winning each of these states by like 5-10 points. It's just literally where the momentum is at the very end and where they break at the very end. So it is hard for me to believe that you're going to get something that's as nice and clean. It sounds like a very interesting scenario, right? Like, oh, you know, Trump gets the Sun Belt, but still loses because
he loses
in
the
three states that he won
North and Midwest
in 2016, right?
Yeah.
And that brings us to the question of, I think that you had raised at the beginning as well, which is, what did these third party candidates do?
Yeah.
And who are they pulling from? You know, I've always thought that the challenge for Biden is that his coalition is more anti-Trump than it is pro-Biden. And as such, there are a lot of voters who are in the leaning Biden camp, but if they had another choice besides Trump, might take that.
Yeah.
Right. So that, I do still think that those third party candidates, could they play the same role today that they did in 2016? Absolutely. Taking just enough to let Trump win, even without getting a majority of the vote in some of those states.
And what's your latest reading of the sort of ballot access question for them? Because again, in some ways, it doesn't matter if they get on the ballot in California and New York. If they're in on those seven key states, what's the latest reading of that? Do you have a sense?
It seems as if you've got, for RFK Jr., it looks, and again, I think there's still some legal maneuvering here, but Nevada, Arizona, Michigan, where he'll be on the ballot. But remember, the Green Party has ballot access in all those states. And so Jill Stein is guaranteed to be on the ballot, not just those swing states, but in the other states. I don't think Cornel West has gotten on any yet. I don't know if he'll have the money to get on any of those states. But the real question in my mind in these swing states like Arizona, Nevada, is how many of the voters who showed up to vote in 2020, but didn't show up in 2022, come back to the polls in 2024 and pull the lever for Trump. Now, they might have voted for Biden last time. And we look at a place like Nevada, where the Latino vote in Nevada in 2022 didn't really change much from where it was in 2020. Democrats didn't do any better, but they didn't do any worse. And I think there were a lot of Democrats who saw that as hopeful. Right. Okay. Maybe this was this one-time thing. It was just a weird election and Trump and the pandemic. And once we get in the presidential year, we're going to turn out a whole bunch of people who will be more open to Democrats. Except when you look at who some of those voters who don't show up to every election, low propensity voters, they actually are leaning more to Trump. So we always talk about turnout. So it's not just about who turns out. It's not just, is it a higher Latino turnout, a higher Black turnout, a higher white turnout, college educated, not college educated. Another factor will be, how often do you actually vote? How committed are you? What kind of voter are you? And Democrats are doing better with those who show up election after election. Republicans, Trump especially, doing better with more infrequent voters.
And how will the issue of sort of voting opportunity affect that? Obviously, last time 2020, we saw huge amount, particular conditions of the pandemic and everything, huge amount of mail-in and absentee and early voting. Do you have a sense yet what sort of a scale that will be? And obviously last time that, as we saw, very clearly as the results came in, when those early votes in particular and mail-in votes came in and heavily favored Democrats, we saw that those were key in many of those states. Do you have a sense whether that will change this time? Obviously, Trump has been going out of his way this time to say, yeah, you know, vote early, vote by mail, whatever, in a way that, of course, they didn't in 2020. A, is that going to be important? And B, could it produce a slightly different outcome from what it produced in 2020?
I do think that Donald Trump has fundamentally altered the way that partisans think about how they will vote and when they will vote, and that you still see it in congressional level races where the early vote is still overwhelmingly Democratic. So I think some behavior has been changed and is not likely to change back, even if Trump is a little more open to accepting it. So the day of vote is still more likely to be Republican than Democratic. But I think the question too is, will we get similar levels of turnout that we had in 2020 and 2024, given that you've got a good, 15 to 20% of the electorate saying, I dislike both candidates. So you have a much more disillusioned, disappointed electorate than you did in 2020. You obviously, because in 2020, many of us were sort of trapped at home anyway, but you have less engagement in politics, whether it's in watching it or reading it or engaging with some form of media than you did back in 2020. So the electorate feels a lot more checked out this time around. And will that change when we get closer? It absolutely could. But for now, I think that it doesn't feel like we're going to hit 2020 levels of turnout.
Quick question on the RFK Jr. vote. There seems a high level of uncertainty about that. First of all, there's uncertainty about the ballot access, which you've just discussed. It's quite a range I see in the polling in terms of what he seems to be getting in different polls. And I've seen polling anywhere between sort of 6 and 15%. I think it was a poll of the weekend that may have been even higher than that. And then particularly if you look at state by state, in some states, he seems to be, when it becomes a five-way race rather than the two-way race, Trump's lead widens dramatically. Maybe in other states it narrows, you know, suggesting in the ones where it widens dramatically that RFK really is pulling votes away from Biden. And kind of, as you said just a couple of minutes ago, what's your sense about that vote in the end, how large it might be, and and what its effect will be on the two main candidates?
My sense is this number is going to continue to go down as we get closer and closer to the election, in part because I think he's been a repository for a lot of voters who are not particularly engaged in this election or who hear the name Trump and Biden and they're like, I'll go for this Kennedy person. Yeah. To me, the biggest challenge that Kennedy has, besides the ballot access issue, is that I don't really know what his message is, other than he's anti-establishment and anti sort of vaccine mandate. Now, there is a portion, as we know, of the electorate that finds this anti-establishment thing very appealing. And quite frankly, that's Trump's appeal as well, that he's the outsider, that he's going to take on the sacred cows, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's this part of you that says, well, an anti-establishment candidate who also happens to be getting a whole lot of media attention from people in the Trump-like orbit, like Glenn Beck and Steve Bannon, that's going to hurt Trump. But I don't know that that's who's sitting in that category right now. Again, I don't know if people know a lot about him other than a last name that sounds familiar, and that they are, again, sort of parking themselves there until they feel like either they make their ultimate choice between the top two candidates, or they decide they're going to stay home. And the message to bring them in, besides anti-establishment, is what, right? Like, I don't really know what RFK Jr., what is his plan? What is his position on Israel? What is his position on abortion?
He's going to spend his entire time reopening the investigations into his father's and uncle's assassinations. I think there's going to be a lot of that. Anyway, look, final question. This has been great. So again, as I said at the beginning, we're 6 months out. A lot can happen. I was just looking back at this stage, you know, in 1988, it was President Michael Dukakis. At this stage, in the summer of 1992, it was President Ross Perot, John Kerry was ahead of George W. Bush this stage in 2000. Well, yeah, of course, in 2016, you know, Hillary Clinton was ahead
by like 10 points. Yeah.
And Biden was ahead of Trump all the way through 2020, and it ended up being close, at least in electoral college terms. So, but I'm not going to ask you, obviously, what's going to happen given the walk of the country. But given that historical background, what are the things that could change the race between now and November 8th? Sorry, November. It's November 5th. I don't want people to go out and vote on November 8th. Sorry.
He was suppressing the vote. He told them it was November 8th. But it's
November 5th.
First Tuesday in November, everybody. First Tuesday. So I'm looking at a number of types of voters. There are those so-called double haters, right? The voters who dislike both. Where do they break? How big is that group of voters as we get closer to the election? Is something going to meaningfully change between now and November in terms of people's feelings of economic stability or optimism? It doesn't feel that way. It doesn't seem like, even if we don't, we're not going to hit a recession or we're not going to get a big bump in inflation, I don't know that voters by November are going to say, boy, things really seem like they're clicking on all gears, economically speaking. But again, I don't know, maybe they will be saying that by October. Maybe they'll be feeling better about the pace of the economy. How many people are voting for Biden and also dislike the job that he's doing? This was a unique thing that popped up in 2022. I've never seen this before, that, you know, normally people who say they disapprove of a president vote against that person or that party. Yeah. But in 2022, there were a lot of voters who said they somewhat disapproved of Biden, who ended up voting for Democrats, and right now who say they're voting for Biden over Trump. So that we look at this data that says, oh, Biden's so unpopular, he only has a 40% approval rating, this is the worst of anybody who's ever run in the modern era, he can't possibly win. But I think that may be not telling the whole story, that there are a lot of people buried in that disapproved number who still aren't going to vote for Donald Trump. They are going to vote for Biden. So those are, I think, some really important things to think about. And then, you know, there's going to be, theoretically, very soon, a decision in this New York court case. But the fact that we're not, at least it doesn't look like we're going to have any other decisions by juries, whether it's in the January 6th trial or the documents case or Georgia case, it seems like that issue of Trump's indictments kind of end up becoming less salient. But again, if Jack Smith is able to take that case to court and something comes out in October, that sure seems like a big factor that we should be thinking about. But fundamentally, you know, I do think that this election, if Biden is to win, it really has to be about Donald Trump and who he is, and separating that from this memory that people say they have of the life as a citizen when Donald Trump was president, when they feel like the economy was better and there was more security on the border. And that, to me, I guess I'll sum it up by saying, traditionally, in a normal election, in normal times, an incumbent who is as unpopular as Biden is, where voters are as anxious about the economy, where the opponent has a lead on something like being in charge of the economy, would doom that incumbent. But we've also been through a number of elections now where the central issue, i.e. the economy, doesn't necessarily tell us what the outcome of the election is going to be. Donald Trump had a lead on who would do a better job on the economy. People were much more optimistic about the economy going into 2020. And yet, Trump still lost. Biden's team should have lost badly in 2022 based on historic level of inflation. And yet, they did pretty well, obviously, not at the Senate and House level. So is it going to be a traditional election where the fundamentals that we've used for many, many years continue to drive the outcome? If that's the case, then Trump is favored. If it's an election where it's not as simple as the fundamentals, where the fundamentals are telling us only part of the story, but other issues, whether it's Trump as the person, whether it's abortion rights and worries about life under Republican president for those sorts of freedoms, and this issue of January 6th and democracy, if those become more salient, if voters are willing to pick the lesser of two evils, and that lesser of two evil happens to be Biden, well, then Biden has a chance to win.
Amy, short of giving us the precise result of the election in 6 months' time, that is about as comprehensive and excellent an analysis as we could possibly hope for. Amy Walter, editor-in-chief and publisher of Cook Political Report with Amy Walter, thank you so much for joining us here on Free Expression.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Free Expression. Thanks very much for joining us. I'll be back again next week with another episode. In the meantime, thank you again and have a great week. Goodbye.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.